Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. I am back from a trip to Italy where I got to sample some delicious springtime foods. The colors and the vibrancy in Italy is just unsurpassed. It's just beautiful. But I'm really happy to be back and seeing the bursting of spring all around me. Of course, we have some rain here in New York today, but it's still beautiful because I know a result of this rain is all the flowers that are to come and the garden and the vegetables. And, you know, this time of year is just so exciting. But I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest is going to be Stephen Drucker. I am so excited to have him on. I've been trying to get him on ever since his book came out in 2015. He is the author of the book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. And as most of you know who follow me, I am a strong believer that GM food should not be on the market. And when you read this book, you will certainly agree. They certainly rushed it onto the market, and we are all guinea pigs for the GMO foods. And so, anyway, I'm thrilled to have him on. We'll be talking about that in just a little bit. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, some ways that you can take action, and also share my weekly recipe with you. So I'm happy to report that Maryland has banned fracking, which is really, really great. We need more and more states to really take this up and to ban fracking. I reported a few weeks ago about the increase of earthquakes that are plaguing different states who allow all of the fracking, and the damage that fracking can do, the polluting it does to our waterways and the land. It's making people sick. It just doesn't make sense. There's so many ways that we can get our energy without doing that, and we need to really invest in renewable energy, and we need to convince this administration. So, you know, one thing that is going to be happening April 22nd is the March on Science, and the following weekend, the Climate March, and I'll be telling you more about that in just a little bit. But I also want to encourage you all to go onto my website and sign some of these petitions that I have. One is to increase banning fracking everywhere. Another one is a petition to prevent the Bayer-Monsanto merger. Bayer and Monsanto are two mega big corporations that control GMO seeds and pesticides and chemicals, and they are just, both of them are really, really bad companies, and putting them together is just going to be the worst. So if you could sign that petition, you'd be doing everybody a good thing. And also, there is a petition to help support and block the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone Pipeline, as many of you, again, who follow me know that I protested a couple of years ago down in Washington, D.C., in front of the White House. I was arrested along with Bill McKibben and others with 350.org and many other organizations. And the Keystone Pipeline is another really bad project for us to be investing money in. Not only is it to extract dirty tar sands oil from Canada and move it through our country, which will, you know, of course, pipelines always leak, and so it's the potential damage to our land and waterways is huge. And then it goes down to the Gulf of Mexico for export. It's not even for us. We don't need it. It's all for export, and it's all for the big corporations' profit. So, again, it's not something that we should be supporting. And, of course, our current administration is not about the people. It's about the corporations. So please sign in and support that. Also, this week coming up is Passover, and next weekend is Easter. And these are opportunities for us all to come together around our communal tables and support tradition. And Slow Food, which is the organization that I'm so deeply involved with, is all about tradition and eating together around the communal table. And I just want to encourage everybody, whatever your tradition is, to share it with others, because that's what makes it rich. By yourself, it's, you know, just another meal. But when you do it with others and you share that energy, that love that comes with food around a communal table, it just takes it to a whole nother level. So I really want to encourage you all to join in with some family, friends, you know, and those that are listening, if you know someone who is not with a family or friends, invite them to your table. Make room for them, because this is an opportunity for us all to come together, and it raises all of us to a whole nother level. So please do that. Also, one thing I wrote about was an article that I read or I heard on PRN was about restaurants and how they are another way of modern slavery. You know, people that are brought here through a slave trade, basically. You know, they buy their way into the country and then they are, I don't want to say sold into slavery, but they're entrapped into slavery in restaurant situations. And it's just a really bad thing. And on my website, you can read about it. It's called In U.S. Restaurants, Bars, and Food Trucks, Modern Slavery Persists. And, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, we've talked a lot about the minimum wage, raising that so that people that work in restaurants can have a decent living. But this is even beyond that. Most of these are undocumented immigrants who aren't even a part of the minimum wage. So read that and just, you know, learn about it and see, you know, ways that you can check in on the restaurants where you eat and make sure that that kind of thing is not going on there. I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and some of the other regional areas. I usually talk about Boston as well and Washington, D.C., and I encourage any of you that live somewhere where there is an event that you'd like to share with me, for me to share with my audience, please send that my way. Tomorrow, actually, there's a venture capital investment for food up in the Boston area at Branch Food. All this information, I'm just going to skim over it because all of it you can find on my website. This Friday night, April 7th, is a great documentary. I actually am hoping to go to this. It's called The Brainwashing of My Dad. It's a free event at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Huntington. And The Brainwashing of My Dad is a great documentary film about how is it that liberal people, as they get older, have turned right wing. And it's really interesting to see this film and watch how the ownership of the media and the right-wing ownership and how that has manipulated people's thoughts. And so what channels people are watching, you know, somebody was telling me they were, you know, in the Midwest and they could not believe what they were seeing on the TV station. So you realize that, you know, the news that is being given to people affects how they feel and how they believe and what they believe. And so this is a documentary film about the brainwashing of my dad. The filmmaker will be there following the film to answer questions and lead a discussion. And again, that's in Huntington. April 7th, there's a human resources boot camp that's being sponsored by the Pro Bono Partnership, which is a great organization that provides free legal counsel to nonprofit organizations. And this is a partnership that they do with the Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And it's a boot camp for nonprofit organizations that actually have a human resource component to it. And it is a full-day event, and they're just a great organization, so I recommend that. April 12th, another documentary screening of Sustainable. This is in the city at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, and it's being sponsored by 350.org's New York City chapter. And it's a film about the land, the people who work it, and what needs to be done to sustain it for future generations. Should be a great film if you can make that. The Cornell Cooperative Extension on Long Island runs different events at libraries in financially challenged communities. And Amy Bly is a nutritionist, and she's running a couple workshops. One is called My Plate and Families, and it's you know, talking about what foods should be on a plate to eat, and that's at the Brentwood Library. And another one the following week on April 20th is about rethinking what you drink, and that is at the Brentwood Library. April 20th, this is, should be a great event, Food Waste, Food Rescue, an Enlightened Eaters panel discussion. This is also a free event being sponsored by Slow Food New York City, and you can find out more on their website. It's also sponsored by the James Beard Foundation and the Natural Gourmet Institute. And it's at God's Love We Deliver, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization delivering food to needy and sick people. But, you know, we all know that food waste is a big problem, and this is looking at some of the organizations that are, you know, coming up with innovative ways to reduce food waste and rescue it and what you can do to do that and be a part of it. April 20th, Standing Rock Musical Performance at Stony Brook, and there will be two indigenous Standing Rock folks along with their full band talking about Standing Rock and performing. And it's a free event open to the public, but it's all the way out in Stony Brook. So if you're out that way, check that out. And if you're not, go into the city to the God's Love We Deliver. But both of those are on April 20th. April 22nd is the March for Science in Washington, D.C. I do not know if there will be a sister march in New York or not. But this is scientists coming together to really, you know, call out to the public to please pay attention to science. We can't be science deniers, and we have an administration that is full of science deniers. And so show your support, join in solidarity, and march for science on April 22nd. There will be a rally in New York City the same day on April 27th for Earth Day, and this is also a climate agenda rally. It's only from noon to 1:30 in Foley Square, but that should be something that you can do if you can't get to Washington, D.C. What else? Oh, there's so many. It's a fundraiser for Food Tank, which is a great organization, on April 27th, which is a dance event to raise money. That should be great. April 29th is the People's Climate March. Now, I have heard they are not doing a sister march in New York City, which really is a bummer for me because I am not able to get to Washington, D.C. that weekend. But I will be in New York City. So hopefully, I'm still hoping last minute, they do organize some sort of sister march in the city. But the People's Climate March is going to be huge in Washington, D.C. I was at the one in 2014 in New York City, and it was amazing, amazing. And there is going to be a farm and food hub contingent marching in the People's Climate March. And I will have Nancy Romer on April 20th to talk about the People's Climate March and that farm and food hub contingent. So stay tuned for that. April 29th is the annual Sheep Shearing Festival at Stone Barns, which is a great agricultural educational center up in Tarrytown. That sells out quickly, so if you haven't gotten your tickets for that yet, I would suggest it. Sustainable film series at Molloy College is coming up on May 4th. And there's many, many more, but I'm not going to say them all because I don't want to take the time away from my guests. So check out my website at ieatgreen.com and find out some of these great events that you can participate in. And please sign those petitions. You know, as I've said so many times before, it is really so important that we all participate, that we all become active members of our democracy, because otherwise we're going to lose our democracy. I actually went to a screening this week of George Orwell's 1984, and oh my God, was it scary, really scary. And you can see the beginnings of what's going on now, and it is scary. So we need everybody to stand up, get out, speak out, and participate. So I hope you show up at some of those marches, and I will see you at some of them for sure. The recipe I'm sharing this week is gluten-free vegan tofu meatballs with a Moroccan tapenade, and this came out just so great. It was delicious. And you can also do it with, you know, you can make these vegan tofu meatballs with a Italian slant if you want to put them over pasta. You can, I've done them before with a Asian slant. So there's many different ways that you can do this. But this Moroccan tapenade is just really great. So you're going to start by sautéing the onions. Well, first let me give you the ingredients. Sorry. 1 pound of tofu. And you're going to press that and remove the water. 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1 cup of chopped onions, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 1 tablespoon chopped ginger, 1 cup of grated carrots, 1 stalk of celery chopped, 2 cups of chopped baby portobello mushrooms, 1 tablespoon of flaxseed that I soaked in 2 tablespoons apple cider vinegar. That's a standard concoction that I make up to use to hold things together instead of an egg. 1/2 cup of fresh parsley, 2 tablespoons of tamari, 1 tablespoon of aji marin, which is sweet rice wine, 1/4 cup of fresh cilantro, 2 cups of fresh spinach chopped, 1 bunch of chives chopped. Actually, with the chives, I find it's even easier to cut it with a scissor. 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, 1/4 cup of sesame seeds, 1/4 cup of gluten-free panko flakes, 2 cups of cooked short grain brown rice, 1 teaspoon of salt. And that's for the meatballs. And then for the sauce, you're going to need 1 onion chopped, 2 cups of baby portobello mushrooms quartered, 2 teaspoons minced garlic, 1/4 cup of red wine, 3/4 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/8 teaspoon of allspice, 1/4 cup of chopped parsley, 1/4 cup of toasted pine nuts, 1 tablespoon of honey, and 1 can of fire roasted tomatoes with chili. And I get those from Trader Joe's, they're great. And then to roll the tofu meatballs in, you're going to, in a little pie pan, put together 3 tablespoons of sesame seeds, 1 pinch of salt, and 3/4 cup of panko flakes, and then have some chopped parsley for garnish. And you're going to start by sautéing the onions and carrots and the celery in olive oil with the garlic and the ginger. And you're going to sauté that until they're soft. You're going to add the portobello mushrooms and cook those down for about 5 minutes. Then add the mirin and the tamari and cook it for another 5 minutes. In the food processor, pulse the parsley and the cilantro until they're really fine. Add the tofu and pulse that some more. Then you're going to add the sautéed veggies and the spinach and pulse that until it's all incorporated. Transfer it to a large mixing bowl and add the brown rice, the chopped chives, the soaked flaxseed, the baking powder, the sesame seeds, the panko flakes, the salt and pepper. And mix that all up well. Combine the panko flakes, sesame seeds, and salt into a bowl or a deep pie pan. Form the mixture into balls the size that you want. I did about 1-inch size. And roll that in the panko mixture. Place it on a greased cookie sheet. Bake it at 375 for about 20 minutes. Turn them over and bake for another 10 to 20 minutes. You want them to really get golden brown and be a little crispy on the outside. And while those are cooking, you can make the sauce. In a heavy skillet, you're going to saute the onions and the garlic in a little olive oil until it's translucent. Add the mushrooms, the cinnamon, the allspice, and the salt, and cook that down until the mushrooms are soft. Add the red wine and cook that down until the liquid is halved. Add the fire-roasted tomatoes, the honey, and the pine nuts, and cook that for 5 more minutes. Then, last minute, stir in the parsley. And you're going to place a few spoonfuls of the tapenade on a serving platter. Place the tofu meatballs on top, and then just spoon a little bit of the tapenade on top of the meatballs as well, or the tofu balls, and garnish it with parsley. And that's it. They're so good. So as always, I love getting feedback from everyone. So if you make them, or when you make them, send me an email and let me know how you liked it. Okay, and now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you Stephen Drucker. As I said, he's the author of the book Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, and he is an attorney, and he is the founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity, And as the executive director, he initiated a lawsuit that forced the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to divulge its files on genetically engineered foods. And that's how he came to write this book, when he found out all the truths behind it. So, Stephen, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Bhavani.
Thank you, Stephen, for joining me. I'm so happy to have you on. It's been a long time coming.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. So can you just give me a little background first? How did you first get interested or suspecting of GMO foods?
Well, it was I started hearing about this massive venture to reconfigure the genetic core of the world's food supply back in late 1995. And I was rather shocked because I had been, I thought I'd been following up on food safety issues for several years, and yet I was not aware of it. And I had no idea that there was several genetically engineered crops that were ready to come to market within the year. And I became very concerned and wanted to learn more about it. And as the introduction of my book explains, the more I learned, the more I became concerned, because it became very, very readily apparent that there was a great gap between the promotional claims being made on behalf of genetically engineered foods and the truth. And in fact, the more I have researched, the greater that chasm has become. It's just astounding the degree to which this massive venture that purports to be based on sound science is actually based on a foundation of falsehood. It's astounding, but my book documents the whole sorry history of this endeavor.
Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to the claims that, you know, science has said that GE foods have been proven safe?
Well, they haven't been proven safe. And any scientist who claims that is not speaking as a scientist, really. Most scientists have been misled. They haven't studied the original research. They're relying on claims by a small cadre of scientists who are pushing this. And that cadre has been disseminating false statements from really the earliest era of the genetic engineering revolution, years before the technology was even able to be applied to plants. And again, to say that these foods have been proven safe, one would have to show that every genetically engineered food has gone through adequate safety testing, and that's clearly not the case. And there are several studies that are published in peer-reviewed scientific journals that raise serious concern about these genetically engineered foods. And some of those actually point to the very process of genetic engineering itself as being problematic, not just the specific foreign gene that was inserted into the organism, but the something disruptive about the genetic engineering process itself.
Now, I know, you know, most of the products that contain genetically engineered foods in this country are able to be made without GMO foods for the European market. Now, does the European market have stricter laws? Is that why they have been able to keep it out of their market? Or what is the reason that we have it and they don't?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Most people do believe that the European Union must have stricter laws regarding genetically engineered foods in the United States, and that accounts for the fact that you don't find genetically engineered foods in European supermarkets, and yet they're pervading the food shelves of American supermarkets. But in reality, the United States has the strictest food safety laws in regard to genetically engineered foods. And if our laws had actually been followed instead of violated, and the FDA has allowed them to be violated, in fact, it has violated them, we wouldn't have these foods on our market either. So it's not a matter of law. the crucial difference really is the fact that the European media gave fairer and more open reporting of the problems of genetically engineered foods back in the 1990s. And there's been an essential media blackout for many years about the ill effects and the problems of genetically engineered foods in the United States. So the European consumers made it very clear that they did not want to eat genetically engineered foods. The major food suppliers gave that message strongly to the manufacturers that they weren't going to stock them, and they haven't stocked them by and large. And so that accounts for the difference, that it was consumer mm-hmm. awareness and consumer resistance.
Mm-hmm. And can we backtrack just a little bit as to what are the laws in this country and what laws were not followed? I mean, what kind of testing should have been done that was not done?
Well, the main food safety law in the United States that's relevant to genetically engineered foods is the Food Additive Amendment to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, I think most people have heard of that. It's one of the oldest, perhaps the oldest, and most venerable consumer protection laws in the United States. And it's been amended a few times since it was first passed. And one of the most important amendments occurred in 1958. And up to that point, additives to foods were presumed safe, and the FDA or other concerned parties had the burden of proving that they were risky. But in 1958, Congress realized that most of the additives to foods that had been coming into the market since the end of World War II were not the traditional kinds of additives like vinegar and salt and pepper, but they were new chemicals that had never before been seen and whose names could rarely be pronounced, and that these chemicals didn't have a history of safe use, and there were good reasons to believe that many of them entailed risks. So the burden of proof was shifted. The law stated that any new additive to our food supply that doesn't have a history of safe use prior to 1958 is presumed unsafe until demonstrated safe, and the manufacturer has the burden of demonstrating safety, and that the new food additives are supposed to be proven safe before they're allowed on the market. And the FDA's regulations, which have become part of that law, state that there has to be a reasonable certainty that they will not create harm. That's a high burden of proof, reasonable certainty of no harm. Really, hardly any prescription drug could pass that because, as we all know, most prescription drugs are known to cause some harm. They all have some side effect, and it's just felt that the benefits will outweigh the side effects. But food additives are supposed to be different. They are not supposed to have any negative side effects because, after all, they're over-the-counter. So every one of these genetically engineered foods should have been demonstrated safe, reasonable certainty of no safety through standard scientific procedures. That's the law. And the FDA has evaded that law and presumed that they're all safe and reversed the burden of proof and let them on the market without requiring one smidgen of safety testing, whereas the law actually does require safety testing.
Mm-hmm. Because I know I have seen many times in literature that, you know, that they presume there to be no difference in the genetic makeup of the GMO product as compared to one that is not. How does someone fight that? You know, it's obviously not true. I mean, they're saying it, that it's been proven that they are the same.
Oh, well, but they're not. In fact, here's an interesting fact, too, that most people are not aware of, Bhavani, and that is that the first objective review, scientific review of the issue of genetically engineered foods was conducted by the FDA's own scientists at the request of the FDA. The agency formed a biotechnology task force, and it had scientists from all the major divisions who thoroughly studied the issue, and their memoranda demonstrate that they overwhelmingly concluded that genetic engineering cannot be equated with traditional breeding, that it entails a unique set of risks. It can create a range of disruptions that can lead to the production of unintended novel toxins or allergens or other anti-nutritive substances. And the FDA scientists stated that as a matter of science, these foods had to be presumed risky and needed to be carefully tested. So they were telling their superiors that what the law required is actually also what sound science requires. But all of those memos, which, by the way, only, as you mentioned, only came to light through the lawsuit that I organized, the bureaucrats, the politically appointed bureaucrats at the FDA, who were following an agenda to promote the biotechnology industry, disregarded all of that scientific input. They covered it up and they lied about it. They told the public that they were not aware of any information showing that genetically engineered foods differ from other foods in any uniform or meaningful way. That's an outright lie. Their files are filled with information from their own experts. And they stated there's an overwhelming consensus in the scientific community that they're safe, so safe they don't need to be tested. When they knew that was not true, they knew the overwhelming consensus within their own scientific staff was that these foods entail risks and have to be tested. And I found a letter in the file from the FDA biotechnology coordinator to a Canadian health official admitting there was not a consensus about safety in the scientific community at large. So the FDA knew there was not a scientific consensus, yet they claimed there was. And as I speak, the sole purported legal basis for the presence of GMOs on the U.S. market is the fraudulent claim of the FDA that there is an overwhelming consensus in the scientific community that they're safe and that they don't need to be tested. And that the FDA, part of that claim is that the FDA is supposed to have solid evidence, technical evidence, that every one of them is safe. But the FDA doesn't have any evidence of that, and they've admitted it as well in more candid moments.
So where's the lawsuit at right now? I mean, why aren't all these GM foods then being pulled immediately from the market?
Well, that's because the judge in the case acknowledged that we had shown, as of the time that we brought the lawsuit, that, and I'm not using the royal we, along with the Alliance for Biointegrity, there were other plaintiff organizations and individual plaintiffs. So there was a group of groups and individuals suing, that we had shown that as of May of 1998, when we filed the lawsuit, that there was significant disagreement among scientists about the safety of these foods, which meant that they were not generally recognized as safe as of that date, and they shouldn't have been on the market. But she stated that basically the issue was not whether they were legally on the market as of the date that we brought the lawsuit. She actually played some technical games. She bent over backwards to support the FDA, and she stated that the only relevant legal issue was whether the FDA administrators had some shred of rational basis for presuming genetically engineered foods were safe back in May of 1992. So she essentially granted that they weren't legally on the market as of 1998, but basically ignored that and just stated the key issue was whether the FDA administrators had some rational basis for presuming that they were that they were safe back in May of 1992. And then, of course, she had to ignore all of the evidence that was in the FDA's files as of May of 1992. She basically said that the FDA administrators could ignore what their own scientists were saying and essentially said they had liberty to even lie about the facts. So it's a shocking decision. She basically just upheld the FDA's, said the FDA had a right to presume that in May of 1992, and that was it. That was basically it. So people don't realize what her decision was. She didn't say these foods ever really were recognized as safe, and she certainly didn't say that they were safe as of the time we recognized as safe as of the time we brought the lawsuit, and she tacitly acknowledged they were illegally on the market when we brought the lawsuit. But she basically evaded facing those critical issues. It's an astounding decision, and most people don't understand what it is. That decision actually supports our position if people actually read what the judge wrote.
So is there an appeal going on or no? It's kind of like put to rest.
As my book explains, an appeal was launched, and it probably almost surely would have been won because the judge ignored key facts. Then the FDA proposed new regulations on genetically engineered foods that would have made our lawsuit moot had they gone into effect. And we surely would have won if we had sued on the new regulations. So a decision was made to drop the appeal and wait for the new regulations and then sue on them, because there would have been no way that the FDA could have won in such a suit. I won't go in. My book explains why. But then the FDA didn't move ahead with the new regulations, and they basically put them on the back burner, never got beyond the proposed state, and we couldn't renew the appeal. We lost our chance. So what is in place is still the FDA's old policy, but we lost our chance to appeal on that through probably some chicanery on the part of the agency by making a big show that they were bringing out new regulations and then never doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's infuriating. I know that I have talked about...
And I haven't even gone into all of the frauds the FDA has perpetrated on behalf of GMOs. It's shocking. You know, that's an agency that's supposed to be serving the public. But when it comes to GMOs, they've clearly been serving the interests of the biotechnology industry and have been going out of their way to violate the law and actually imperil the food supply by allowing products onto the market that were unreasonably risky in the eyes of their own experts. When I say unreasonably, meaning unreasonable to presume they were safe without having been demonstrated safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see that, I mean, they do that with, like you mentioned earlier, with drugs as well. I mean, that HPV vaccine that everybody ran out to get their girls, you know, vaccinated, you know, is now showing potential of not being able to have a baby, you know, becoming sterile from it. I mean, you just don't know, and you know, they're just too quick to vote in the favor of industry and not the people. But
even though the FDA, you know, is clearly can be criticized to a large extent on the way that they relate to the pharmaceutical industry, there are laws in place that are enforced for pharmaceutical companies to have to go through long, extensive testing before a new drug is allowed on the market. And even then, we know many drugs are recalled after having passed through all of that. But at least there is testing, now in animals and then human clinical trials. There's been very shoddy animal testing with GMOs and no clinical human testing. So there's a great, great difference between the way that genetically engineered foods are dealt with and the way that pharmaceuticals are dealt with.
Right. But the one thing that I believe is the same is that the FDA doesn't do their own testing. They rely on the companies to do the testing. And that's like, you know, just a setup for lying and deceitfulness and, you know, not really getting to the truth.
Well, that's a good point. You're right on that the FDA relies on the tests that are conducted either by the company or under the auspices of the company, people that are hired by the company to test. And that certainly sets up a lot of room for shenanigans.
Yeah, like we know Monsanto controls the results of their testing. And so if a result is not advantageous to their product, they don't need to release those results. And then they do a different test until it shows the result they want, and that's the one that they're going to share with the public. But anyway, Stephen, let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, we can get into some more of those details. Everyone, don't go away. I'm talking with Stephen Drucker from Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Be right back.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Eric Davis, and I want to invite you to join me for Expanding Mind, a show that features conversations about the cultures of consciousness, magic, meditation, neuroscience, religion, technology, psychedelics, weird media. Expanding Mind is devoted to changing your perspective without insulting your intelligence. Tune into the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and check out the archive page for Expanding Mind on PRN.FM. And remember, keep your minds open.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and Ayit Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Stephen Drucker, author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Stephen, back with me?
Yes.
Great. So, you know, talking about GE foods and the concerns that so many of us that are in the know have about them, you know, a lot of people, you know, say that GE food deniers are similar to climate change deniers. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond that the people who make that claim are not at all aware of the facts and haven't been doing a thorough analysis, because there's such a diametric difference. Now, think about it. The whole climate denial phenomenon has been fomented and funded by the major industries, the fossil fuel industries, that stand to profit by throwing doubt on the reality of climate change and that human activity is causing it, so that they can continue their polluting activities. And in that case, the overwhelming majority of objective, independent scientific experts is opposed to the industry position and stating that climate change is happening and that it's driven by, and that it's being significantly influenced by human activity. And so there you have a case of a genuine scientific consensus, and it's being opposed by industry. And by the way, also most governments, including the U.S. government, or at least up to current, I should say, U.S. government up until the recent administration, had also been coming out with warnings about climate change. In the case of genetically engineered foods, you've got an unholy alliance between the industry that's pushing the foods and scientists who are misrepresenting facts, and that can be demonstrated. My book demonstrates that. Most of them are, many of them, I should say, that the biggest pushers have some financial stake in it as well. And, you know, you've got it. And then also in the case of the U.S., you've got government agencies that have been pushing GMOs as well. And it's kind of frightening when you see it. Now, in the case of science, climate science, I don't think that there are instances where the climate scientists own stake in, you know, in renewable energy companies. They don't have financial conflicts of interest. But one sees massive financial conflicts of interest in the case of genetically engineered food.
Right.
So, again, those of us, at least I know most of us, who are raising concerns about genetically engineered foods, many of us are scientists, and those of us who don't have degrees in science are taking a very scientific approach, and we're basing our approach in the facts. That's scientific. And the other side continues to misrepresent facts. That is documented. My book documents case after case in which the facts have been twisted or suppressed. And the amazing thing is that one has to realize that it is incontestable that the facts, irrefutable, that the facts have been systematically distorted by the proponents of genetically engineered foods. And that raises the question, if the facts have to be distorted systematically in order to argue for safety, that in itself is an indication of how strongly the evidence raises reasonable doubts. Because if one has the facts on his or her side, one doesn't have to distort the facts. One is proud to present them simple and clearly. And it's only when the facts go against you that you resort to trickery and you have to deceive people. And that in itself should raise a huge red flag in the minds of anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one thing you said that's so true is, you know, if you follow the money, if you see where people have an investment in it, you know that the truth is going to be distorted. I mean, so many science programs at universities that do the testing are funded by the type of companies like Monsanto and Bayer. And, you know, they're paid off. And I've also, you know, shown in the past, many of the news media are also paid and, you know, and paid off basically by these companies to report and to distort the facts. So it's a systematic delusion that takes place. And, you know, as consumers, we need to really do the research and look at where we're finding the facts. I mean, you have to really kind of be an investigator or trust those that were the investigator like you to get to the bottom of the truth, because otherwise there's so much misinformation out there. I know Jane Goodall, who is, you know, one of my idols, you know, she said your book is, you know, one of the most important books of the last 50 years. And she especially pointed to the chapter that talks about the malfunction of mainstream media. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, you know, what I'm talking about, and add to it.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, there's a chapter in my book on the malfunction of the mainstream American media, and it shows that they have become pliant accomplices in the cover-up and the fraud that is has gone on to enable genetically engineered foods to thrive and to survive. In fact, if the media had actually been fairly reporting the facts, we probably wouldn't have any genetically engineered foods on the market today. As I mentioned earlier, it would be more like the situation in Europe. And the what has happened is the media in this country have gone out of their way to put a happy face on genetic engineering, especially for the food supply. And they have refused to usually even acknowledge that there are many well-credentialed scientists that have concerns. The media has always frame it as science versus emotional, uninformed activists. And then when they have been presented evidence concrete evidence. In fact, I presented the media time and again, reporters, producers, files from the FDA, memos, copies of memos showing what the FDA scientists said, how it contradicted what the public statements of the FDA are. And time and again, the media has suppressed that. Even when investigative reporters, even an investigative, one of the main technology reporters for the Washington Post, wanted to do a major expose based on the information I had provided him, and he wrote it up, his editor refused to let that run, chopped it up, took all of the damaging information out of it, and the piece that ran was sanitized to the extent that it indicated that there were no legitimate concerns about food safety, when, of course, the piece that he originally wrote had shown that there were legitimate concerns on the part of many scientists and the FDA's own scientists. So, and that's the Washington Post that beats its chest every year on the anniversary of Watergate. But when it came to genetically engineered foods, they basically were protecting the industry and refused to allow the American public to learn what the FDA scientists had actually said. And that kind of suppression of the information from the FDA files has gone on time and again. That's why most of your listeners probably are not aware of it unless they've read my book already.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I also, you heard in the introduction, I was talking about this film called Brainwashing of My Dad. I mean, the media is owned by right-wing corporate businessmen who profit from the public thinking as they want them to think. And so this brainwashing is taking place in so many different areas, whether it's with the climate, whether it's with the GMOs, whether it's with immigration, you know. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's just, you know, they are manipulating the facts in such a way so that they paint a picture, and the picture is one of fear and belief in what the corporate America wants us to believe. And so it's just a huge problem, you know. This new administration talks about anti-media, but they're talking about it from the wrong side. You know, I mean,
well,
media,
I think
it's
important to note, though, Bhavani, that even media that are not really, I don't know if we could say that all the media are owned by right-wing businessmen, but even the New York Times, which is thought to be more liberal, has behaved very badly when it comes to genetically engineered foods. And
has been
very systematically twist their reporting and does not bring out negative evidence and does not do a thorough job of investigating and tends to basically report the propaganda from the industry and its supporters as if it's scientific fact. So it's a very sorry state of affairs, and it's something that really, as Jane said in an interview once, that chapter on the media is one of the most chilling chapters in my book, and my book is one of the most chilling books she's ever read. Because when you think about it, there has been self-censorship on the part of the mainstream American media. The government hasn't been censoring them, but it's the kind of censorship, it's the kind of suppression of discussion of a topic that one would have found in Stalinist Russia, done by Pravda, just towing the party line and afraid to report what the government doesn't want you to report. But here we're supposed to have a free press that is the watchdog on the government. And the press has time and again been provided irrefutable evidence of a major government fraud, and they have refused to report it. That is frightening.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, besides reading your book, which I will encourage everybody to go out and purchase, and there's links on my website to it as well. But in addition to that, are there things that people can do, whether it's, you know, petition seems like too easy and too little. What can people do to try to raise awareness and try to get these GMO foods off the market?
Well, of course, one of the main things is just, and it's the most self-interested thing as well, is protect yourself and your family. Become aware, read labels, become aware of the genetically engineered ingredients and the foods that contain them or are likely to contain them, and vote with your pocketbook. You know, stop buying genetically engineered foods or products that contain them. And if enough people, in fact, there is a trend now, more and more people trying to avoid them. And the more that happens, that sends a major message to industry, but it's also doing a favor for yourself and your family. So that's very important.
I've seen some doctors actually prescribe a GMO-free diet to try to, deal with allergies and autoimmune things that are going on in their bodies. And there's been dramatic changes. I mean, just an anti-GMO-free diet, or a GMO-free diet, not anything, a GMO-free diet can make the difference in your health.
Well, that'll be a healthier way to eat generally, because it means you're going to be eating more organic food. So it is a healthier thing. It's a healthier way to go. I think it's also important to speak to people. Everybody has a range of influence, and it's important to get the facts and then stand up against the propaganda and push back against it. And you never know who you talk to that actually knows somebody who has a lot of influence who could do something. So,
That
saying, think globally, act locally, and it's easier to act where you are, making just simple changes for your life and becoming more informed and then speaking out, and do whatever you feel you can do to have some influence or to start, every time pebbles are dropped in a pond, it creates ripples. So thing is to create
Stephen,
positive ripples.
Stephen, we're just about out of time.
So
before they cut us off, can you share with everybody your website and how they would get in touch?
Yes. Well, again, as you mentioned, the name of the book is Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. The subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. The website for the book is alteredgenestwistedtruth.com. The website for the Alliance for Biointegrity is biointegrity.org, biointegrity.org. Both those sites have a lot of information on them.
And I'll have all these links on my website as well. I said I'll have all these links on my website as well, so people can find them on my website.
Okay. I want to mention there's been a problem with the Alliance for Biointegrity website, and it's currently being reconstructed. So if you find a little trouble navigating there, have some patience, and it should be in better shape very soon.
Great. Well, thank you, Stephen, so much for joining me. And everybody out there listening, thank you for joining me, and I'll see you all again next week. Have a wonderful Passover if you're celebrating, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.